Welcome, baseball amigos, to the latest episode of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available exclusively via the Nats GM Radio Network. I'm your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the baron of all baseball podcasts. The Nats GM Show is sponsored by No Halftime and the No Halftime app. Please go to NoHalftime.com for more information. Now, let's get to our special guest.
This is Matt from MattsBats.com, and you're listening to the Nats GM Show.
And now, we are proud to welcome writer at Baseball Perspectives, Meg Rowley. Meg, welcome to the Nats GM Show.
Thanks for having me.
First and foremost, for those in the audience that don't know you, I'd love to just kind of start with your background a little bit in how you got into sports writing, how you became, I mean, when I think of the Seattle Mariners, I think of you, Meg. So it's just a little background in how you became such a diehard fan and maybe how you got to Baseball Perspectives.
Sure. So I'm from Seattle. I live here again now. So I grew up a Mariners fan and was able to sort of enjoy those late 90s, early 2000 Mariners teams that were really good and fun and had amazing players and, you know, won 116 games. And so that was my introduction to baseball and baseball fandom. And it's, you know, it's been a little rougher since then as a Mariners fan. But sort of always enjoyed the game and didn't really start sports writing per se until I was in graduate school. I was getting a PhD in political science and was, you know, focusing in political theory and political philosophy, and found sports to be actually a really interesting lens and avenue to look at the world and the political world. And when I started enjoying writing about that more than reading Hobbes, it became clear that it was probably time for me to not get a PhD in political science anymore. So I moved back to Seattle and started writing over at Lookout Landing, which is one of the SB Nation sites for the Mariners, and was lucky enough to start freelancing for Just a Bit Outside when that was still up and running over at Fox Sports. And then Sam Miller, formerly now of Baseball Perspectives, that feels weird to say.
R.I.P.
Yeah. I'm sure Sam is tired of people talking about him like he's died or something. He gets to go do really cool stuff at ESPN, and we're all going to be lucky enough to get to read him more often. So that's cool. But he was nice enough last fall to ask me to come on and write for Baseball Perspectives, and that's how we got here. So a little brief history.
Well, very, very cool. I've been wanting to have you on the show basically since the Hall of Fame inductions a couple of months ago. But before I jump into old school Mariners, I'd love to just start with kind of the current 2016 Mariners. As we're recording this, just so everybody knows, the Mariners are 81-72, two games out of the wild card. So just starting there. But I want to kind of start just with the kind of the feeling with you and with the fan base of the 2016 Mariners. It seems like this has been a pretty successful year overall.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I think that the fan base has been pretty happy. I mean, they're in it in September, right? We care about what the Mariners do in this next little bit. And if they, you know, play well and win out or win mostly out and some things break their way, they will finally break that 15 season postseason drought. God, that makes me feel old. They haven't been in the postseason for like half of my life. Half of my life. Wow. Do better, Mariners. So I think that if you take the season on its own terms, right, as the first year of a new regime, so you have Jerry Dipoto in his first year as GM and sort of importantly have a new player development system sort of in hand, you would look at this team and say they've been really successful, right? They've certainly played themselves into contention in September. They've had some really great memorable moments. They've managed to survive some pretty poor play, mostly due to injury in the starting rotation, and guys kind of having to stretch and spot start more than anyone would have liked them to. And they're still a relevant baseball team in September. And I think on those terms, we would look at this season and say, okay, this is a great start for a new GM. And we've seen the farm system, certainly not become one of the best in baseball, but rebound from some pretty tragic lows that we've experienced over the last couple of years. All seven of the Mariners minor league affiliates made their playoffs. They all had great years. We've seen some really sort of impressive development from guys that maybe got written off under the Zarensic era and might have some use as major leaguers at some point down the road. And that's all really good and exciting. But I think you also have a lot of Mariners fans taking those expectations of this given year and worrying about them within the context of what we might expect in future years. And that's where this feels like a success. But if they don't end up making that second wild card, maybe not quite the success we were hoping for, because the reality of this team is that much of the core is aging. And some of the sort of cornerstones of this franchise are not playing the way that they were at one point. You know, Felix has had a very odd year and one that isn't particularly encouraging. So I think taken by itself, this is a good start. Understanding the trajectory of this team over the next couple of years, it's hard to feel like, you know, we might have missed an opportunity to watch at least this iteration of the Seattle Mariners in the postseason. So,
and it's funny you use the word odd, because that was the exact word I have written down in my notes of odd season, because yeah, it seems like the starting pitching, which has been the strength, goodness, what, the last decade or so of this team, hasn't necessarily been great. I mean, Felix has been pretty good and James Paxton has been pretty good, but, you know, Iwakuma has been this and that. But it seems like the offense with Cano rebounding and Seager and Cruz has been kind of some of the strength of the team along with the bullpen.
Yeah, it's I think when you look at sort of the worst month that they had as a team, they had a really, really just god awful June. And I was looking back at this a couple days ago, the only starter who broke camp as a starter, right, who left spring training in the rotation to not do any time on the disabled list is weirdly Iwakuma, right, who's only a Mariner because the Dodgers looked at his shoulder and were like, there's spiders in here. I don't know. Like, this freaks us out. We don't want to give this guy the contract we did. So he was like literally a Los Angeles Dodger. He was on another team and now he's a Mariner and he's the only one who didn't do time on the disabled list. So I think that when you look at the struggles that they've had, especially on the pitching side, you know, a lot of guys were hurt. Some of them were pitching hurt. Some of them were just wholesale unavailable. And the thing that happens when starters can't go deep happened, right? Like, it taxed the bullpen. The bullpen was giving up saves. They were blowing leads late. That month was really hard, and there have been others like it. And I think that when we look back on this season, the fact that they were able to sort of hold on the way that they did and hang in the way they did is going to be really amazing, considering how much time this team has lost to injury in the rotation. And it's weird as a Mariner fan to look at a game and be like, oh, well, they're only down two runs. They can score two runs. They got Cano and Cruz and Seager. This is fine. That's a very weird new reality for us, because I saw the last, like, you know, 10, 15 years of my Mariners fandom, probably not 15, but for the last little bit here, it's been, oh, they're down by two. Well, I guess I have housework to do, so I don't need to pay as much attention to this game. And the identity of the team has really changed. And I think that when we think about their identity going forward, it's going to depend on some of the younger starters that you name, like Paxton or Taijuan Walker, for example, and what their contributions end up looking like. Because if this version of James Paxton sticks around, or if the Taijuan Walker who, you know, almost threw a perfect game against the Angels sticks around, well, then they're out. Outlook as a team looks really different over the next couple of years. If their best pitcher is this version of Felix, then, you know, it's going to be rougher. So it's been a weird year. It's been a fun year. They've done a lot of fun stuff.
So what is your gut feeling about the, let's say, the 2017, 2018 and down the road of the Mariners? Are you on, do you fall in the category of positive, or are you a little negative?
So I think that next year's team is going to look probably a lot like this one. And if pitcher health is better and the other health remains the same, I think that they are probably a contending team, right? If they can keep the rotation intact more consistently, I think that they're a team that can contend, especially if this offense keeps sort of humming along the way that it has. I think I feel much more confident in this offense now than I did at the beginning of the year, just seeing that Cano is really looking a lot like his old self and is not jumping off a cliff like we were kind of worried he was at the end of last year. So I think that if the pitching can stay healthy, they're a contending team. Now, that doesn't mean that the Rangers won't find a new and magical way to be good and lucky. And it doesn't mean that the Astros will have the same kind of gross start that they did that really has made their margins for error much smaller. So I think they're still going to have a hard time in division. But I don't know. I think the 2017 Mariners could be pretty good. I think the 2018 Mariners will be older. So we'll see. And after that, you know, it takes a while to replant and sort of revitalize the farm system. And they don't have a lot of help coming. So if they don't get good production at the major league level, if DePoto isn't able to, you know, do 97 different trades in the offseason to find useful sort of complementary pieces, it might get kind of bleak after that. But I think next year is probably okay. I mean, like, this version of James Paxton can hang with anybody. So right. If we have him all year, look out. I wouldn't want to try to hit 100 from the left side with command. Like, good gravy. So, I don't know. I'm going to be optimistic because they're still in it in September. It's not gross and rainy out yet. It's not time to be sad.
Well, I'm not going to ask you to make a prediction on the wild card, but I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the recent Steve Clevenger incident, I guess is maybe the right word. Both your take just as a fan and kind of, you know, a Mariners fan and just a baseball fan in general, just kind of your thoughts.
Well, I think my thought is that so I was pretty pleased with the way that the team handled it by doing it the way that they did. And obviously we don't know if the MLBPA is going to try to contest his suspension at all. But basically, I think there were a lot of people who wanted the Mariners to just cut him outright. And I totally understand that impulse. Like, the things he said were obviously deplorable. The apology wasn't much better, candidly. This way, they're not paying him any more money. And I would imagine that he is probably the most obvious and easy non-tender decision that a baseball team has faced in a long time. So, you know, he's not going to be in a Mariners uniform again, I wouldn't think. I think that, you know, one of the things that this shows is that you have to be aware of the fact that you are a representative of your team pretty much all the time. I think that what he said would be deplorable regardless of whether it happened in the clubhouse or in his home. But the fact that it happened on social media with a really clear-cut and collectively bargained social media policy in place made this a pretty easy decision on their part. I mean, I don't know how you bounce back from the things he said, which we won't repeat because they don't merit repeating. But I was disappointed. I mean, I was surprised mostly because I hadn't thought about Steve Clevenger in like 3 months because Steve Clevenger played like 22 games for the Mariners this season and had been out with a broken hand. And then I think had a setback in his rehab. And so we were, you know, pretty confident as fans that we weren't going to see him again and weren't particularly sad about it because, you know, the thing about Steve is that in addition to maybe not being the best person, he's not a particularly effective major leaguer. I know that there was a lot of conversation after it happened that, you know, the reaction might have been different if this were a more prominent player that had done it. And I think that, you know, that would be a more sort of telling and difficult test. But I am glad that the Mariners passed the test that was in front of them.
Yeah,
I
thought Seattle actually handled it as frankly as well as they could in a kind of unfortunate situation. So,
I do think I don't want to editorialize too much. I know this is we're talking about baseball more than anything, but I think that it does go to show that when public figures make apologies on stuff like this, it's pretty easy to tell who gets it and who doesn't. When your apology for making racist comments is to your employer first and foremost, I don't think that you're fully understanding the damage you've done or the harm that you've caused to the people who actually are impacted by your comments. So I think that I hope that Steve Clevenger learns from this and has conversations with people who think about it carefully and appreciates the error of his ways. And I think until he demonstrates that he's done that, baseball won't miss him. So,
yeah, it's a shame because I don't know Steve, but I have people that know Steve and have always spoken very highly of his character. So I hope it's just a large misstep in an otherwise good man's character. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know him, so I won't speculate what kind of person he is. But this doesn't serve as a very good character reference. Let's put it that way. But
and maybe we'll.
I think he's going to have a lot of time to. He's going to have a lot of time to think about it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Let's use that as a jumping off point to let's talk about more happier times with the old school Seattle Mariners, if I can.
Yeah.
First and foremost, I wanted to just talk to you a little bit, as I alluded to earlier. I was have been wanting to talk to you since Griffey went into the Hall, goodness, 6-8 weeks ago at this point. Just first your take on growing up watching Griffey, watching him go into the Hall this summer, and then I want to know a little bit about how the fan base views Ken Griffey Jr., you know, 15 years after the trade now.
Yeah, I don't know if I can quite articulate like the blend, the sort of amalgamation of pride and covetiveness, if that's the right word, that Mariners fans felt about Griffey when he was in his prime here. You know, to have the most recognizable, you know, sort of most beloved consensus best player in baseball be a Seattle Mariner was this incredible joy. Like, everyone knew Griffey. People who had never been to Seattle, who didn't know where Seattle was, loved Griffey because he was that sort of obviously irrepressibly cool as a player, as a person, as a personality for the game. I think that there were times where I would, you know, as like the little kid version of my psyche would be like, but Griffey's ours. Like, everyone stop acting like Griffey belongs to everybody. Griffey belongs to Mariners fans. And in hindsight, I can look back on that and sort of appreciate how silly that was, because what an amazing thing. Like, I don't know that we've had a player like him since that has been able to sort of transcend not only his team for other baseball fans, but the sport for non-baseball fans. Like, people who did not care about or like baseball knew about Griffey, right? Like, he was on TV shows, he was in movies, he had a presidential campaign, you know, not a real one, but like he was that important of an icon to American sport. And you know, I think baseball has sort of been chasing someone to be like that since, because you know, even the sort of most amazing players that we have playing now, and there are, you know, obvious future Hall of Famers playing baseball right now, none of them have the same kind of mass appeal that Griffey did. So to see him sort of recognized for the player he was and the contribution he made to the sport, and to have him go into the Hall of Fame as a Seattle Mariner, you know, I cry easily as a person, like both when I'm happy and when I'm sad, like not in a weird way, but I cry easily. Like, I tear up at things when I feel feelings. And I cried during his Hall of Fame induction, because being a Mariners fan can feel a lot like suffering a lot of the time. You know, it's been a long time since this team has been relevant and credible, and it's certainly been a long time since they've been in the postseason. And even a player like Felix, who is so so dear to us here and so important to our continued allegiance to baseball, his career is marked in a lot of ways by that same sort of disappointment that the team overall couldn't be more. And so for us to look at the guy who goes in with the highest percentage of the votes ever and to have him wearing a Mariners hat, you know, it's just like we are relevant to this conversation. We are a part of this sport. And even if we've had a lot of sort of nonsense and suffering, we get to look at Griffey and say, like, this guy was ours. Like, the part of his career that anyone cares about, sorry, Reds fans, like, that anyone cares about happened here. And, you know, that's amazing. So it was pretty cool. They did a whole weekend in Seattle for him with events and bobbleheads and giveaways and everything. And he came back and he spoke. And I've never seen Safeco that full for that many days in a row. And to see the city really just come together and embrace this guy who meant so much to sports here in Seattle and certainly was one of the things that helped keep the Mariners in Seattle as a team. It was really amazing.
And conversely, I want to ask you about another player who retired recently, A-Rod, who certainly spent at least the early part of his career in Seattle. You grew up with him similarly. What do you remember about A-Rod? And then how is he viewed by the Mariners fandom kind of at this point? And I also kind of your take on how he went out, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that he's one of those figures where, you know, whether you're a Mariners fan or not, there's not a lot of consensus around A-Rod. I think that people who sort of exist in the sabermetric community part of baseball fandom tend to view him pretty favorably because we're not as fussed about the PED part. And I think sort of appreciate what his career was before he was tagged with any of that stuff. But I don't think that is the general feeling on A-Rod. And I don't think it's necessarily the feeling on him among Mariners fans. I mean, I remember when he left for Texas, I was, you know, young and really mad because I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe he didn't want to stay here. I couldn't believe that he had all these demands. You know, it felt like we had done everything we could and I was too young to know the difference, and I couldn't believe that he would just leave for money. And now I'm like, well, yeah, you should go and get paid though, because that's what your job is. Your job is to play baseball for money, so you should probably get as much of it as you can. So my feelings on him have changed since I've been able to sort of think more critically about the world than I did as a young person. I think that his story is probably one of the most interesting stories of an individual player in the history of baseball. I wish that we sort of were able to appreciate the beginning part of his career more. I feel like it gets totally lost how transcendent and obviously transcendent a player he was in his youth. Getting to watch him was really magical. I mean, he was just so good and so young. And that combination, you know, when we were Mariners fans, so we're like thinking about him as like, this is the next Griffey, right? This really young, really good, really electric player. I think that we forget that he kind of had a Hall of Fame career before he ever left Seattle. Like he was a generational talent, and we don't really think about that much anymore. And I do wonder how his legacy would be different if he had never left Seattle. You know, I think
that's
the Mariners probably would have won a World Series. So I try not to think about it too much, but I do wonder, because I think he got dinged popularity wise by taking a max contract. And then of course the steroids thing, you know, sort of cast him in a different, very different kind of light as not only a player, but a person. And so I think a lot of the sort of early joys of him get forgotten, but man, he was a sight to see.
Yeah. I mean, he may not have been Bonds for that 2-year stretch, but for about a 5-year stretch, he was probably the greatest player I've ever seen.
Yeah. And just like, there are players now where you rarely see it in every aspect of their game. I mean, I guess Trout is probably the most consistently this way, but you looked at A-Rod as a young player and it just looked so easy.
Yes.
Like you didn't really see any of the effort behind the movement, right? Like it just looked like this is what this man's body is meant to do. This is what it was put here for. Like this is the natural sort of range of motions that this human being's body does. And I think about, like sometimes this is a really like very trivial comparison because he's a great player, but he's not young A-Rod. But like sometimes Robinson Cano will make defensive plays and you're just like, how are you this good and look so casual at the same time? Like how do those two things sit together? And A-Rod was that in every aspect of his game all the time. Like that was how was how it felt watching him. So, I was sad when like the end of his career was sort of the Yankees maybe playing him and maybe not. And, at that point, like now it seems a little bit different as a decision because despite selling at the deadline, they were like still playoff relevant until a couple of days ago. But, I was like, what do you have to lose? Just play A-Rod every day. Your season sucks. Like, just let the man play out his time and close your chapter with him on a good note. And I mean, I think that they kind of ended up mostly doing right by him in the end, but if you had asked me before the steroid stuff, before the suspension, what kind of going away the game was going to give to Alex Rodriguez, it didn't look anything like this. And it's crazy to think that like we're sitting here celebrating Ortiz, who's having this amazing retirement season. And I don't mean to take anything away from him, but like the fact that David Ortiz, who's a very good baseball player, I think he'll be a Hall of Famer one day, but that he got this, fanfare, and Alex Rodriguez like basically got cut and then actually got cut from the Yankees it's crazy to think about.
Yeah, that's a great
I get
point.
All the reasons why, but it's still nuts.
Now, let me use David Ortiz as a jumping off point for the last player that I really want to ask you about. And maybe it's an elevator pitch for his Hall of Fame candidacy, but Edgar Martinez is one of my favorite players growing up as a youth. And I think we've talked about this on another podcast that he should be a slam dunk Hall of Famer. But just a place here, if nothing else, just to try to pitch his candidacy.
Sure. So I was, when you told me before the podcast that we were going to talk, about him, I went and looked at, just to remind myself sort of where he is ranked, sort of historically with WAR and sort of what his career ended up being. And the ding against Edgar getting into the Hall of Fame, at least the one that we hear most consistently from, the sort of grumpy grumps that I assume are NL voters. I don't know who are National League voters. We're going to assume yes. Who will not vote for him for Hall of Fame is that he played, he played the majority of his career at designated hitter, and it's not a position that fields, and so he doesn't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. These are also people who gleefully vote for relief pitchers, but we'll set that logical inconsistency aside. And just say that, like, if you look at him, his baseball reference WAR is 68.3. He had more games at third than say David Ortiz had in the field. And so in 20 seasons of play, David Ortiz, who we think of as a probably consensus Hall of Famer, maybe not a first ballot Hall of Famer, but like I think that most people would look at Ortiz and say that he's going to make the Hall of Fame, right?
Agreed.
Like,
agreed.
Most people think that. And he, if you go by baseball reference WAR, he has a career WAR of 55.5, including this season, where he is having, a tremendous year at DH, but like he added 5 of that WAR this season.
So he's only 20% behind Edgar. Only.
Right. And played, you know, less of his career in the field. Not that I think that that should matter. And he played, he accumulated that WAR playing 2 years longer than Edgar did. Edgar played in Seattle his entire career. The Designated Hitter Award is named after Edgar Martinez. His career slash line, 312, 418, 515. His career OPS is 933. Why is this man not in the Hall of Fame? It's madness. Like, it's, and I think the part of it is that people look at him and they say, well, you know, he played DH and he doesn't have the same postseason sort of experience in history that Ortiz does. And I think that will end up being a really important part of Ortiz's Hall of Fame candidacy, because, you know, he was not only so important to the Red Sox, but so important to the Red Sox in the postseason. You know, he had his really tremendous inspirational moment for the city after the Boston Marathon bombing. He is sort of intimately linked to that city. And I think that, you know, the Hall of Fame is about telling stories. It's about telling baseball stories. And part of that story is the greatness of its players. And part of that story is their life and experience and impact on the game. And so I think that stuff is relevant. And I think that if you look at Edgar Martinez, he has some of that too. I mean, he's responsible for the most famous hit in Mariners history. He hit the double in 95. Like, he... people talk about Griffey saving baseball in Seattle, and to be clear, like, no individual player saved baseball in Seattle, but if Griffey, you know, if Griffey scooting around the bases saved baseball, he doesn't get to do that without Edgar driving him in. So I think when you look at the impact he had as a hitter on the game, if you look at the impact he had on Seattle as a baseball city, if you look on the impact, if you look at the impact he's still having on this team, I mean, hitting coaches and how much they matter is, I think, an open question, and one that, you know, somebody's Hall of Fame candidacy shouldn't hinge on. But he's still a part of the Mariners family. He's the hitting coach for the team. And you look at guys who have really struggled or who had hard times, and they talk about how sort of important his approach has been. I mean, Mark Trumbo credits his season this year to A-Rod's work with him last season in Seattle. So I think that when you take all those things together, the baseball case to me is just obvious. And then you take all that other stuff, and it's a great story, and he should be in the Hall of Fame. And the fact that he isn't feels like stubbornness more than anything else. So that's my kind of long-winded elevator pitch. Hopefully it was a tall building, so the elevator speech can last for a little
and
while.
I'm hoping a couple of the voters actually heard that, because that was a great, great pitch for his candidacy, and he should walk in. So,
yeah, I think that he will make it eventually, but I worry that it won't be on sort of the normal ballot, that it'll take, you know, the Veterans Committee or whatever it is to bring him in. But I think one of the things that might help him, I know that Jay Jaffe has talked about this a bit, is that, you know, it's sort of the really crowded ballots where there were a lot of obvious candidates. Some of that's going to peter out a bit over the next stretch. So maybe, you know, part of what has been keeping him out is that other players are sort of nearing the end of their eligibility, and maybe other voters felt that they had to cast ballots for those guys instead of Edgar. But vote for Edgar. Edgar for Hall of Fame. Let's just make it easy.
Yeah.
Think about how cool it would be if Griffey went in, and then the next year Edgar went in, and then in a couple of years we'll get Ichiro, and we'll just have all these Mariners in the Hall of Fame, and it'll be like my childhood enshrined in Cooperstown.
And
that sounds great.
And put Felix in there in another 10. It'll be great. Yeah.
Yes, I hope so.
So before I let you go, I do want to ask one more topic, a little more on a lighter side of baseball. But a couple of days ago, you wrote about the, I guess, pilot episode of the TV show Pitch with my favorite actor from my childhood, Zach Morris, a.k.a. Mark Paul Gosselaar. And I just finished watching the show kind of as we were talking off air, and I liked the show, but I find it a little confusing in a way. I'd love to kind of just hear your thoughts on the show in general.
So Jarrett Seidler and I will be reviewing it sort of as long as it's interesting to people over at Baseball Prospectus every week. So you'll get to hear our takes on it episode by episode. But I think I was nervous to watch it, obviously. I would love to see a woman play professional baseball in the United States. I talked about crying easily. This will be one of those moments when it comes. And so I was, the subject is really important to me as a woman and as a baseball fan. And so I was nervous about how well they were going to portray not only the baseball, which I think, you know, a lot of baseball art interpreted broadly, whether it's, you know, TV or movies, is fantastical in some way, right? Because a TV episode can't be 3 hours long, so it's not going to exactly feel like a baseball game. And that's fine, but I think whenever you're watching a TV show, there's like a certain amount of disbelief that you're willing to suspend in order to have the show follow the beats that a TV show has to follow. But it was really important that some of the little things were done well and done correctly. And I think that for a TV show portraying baseball, they did a really fantastic job of that. Like, it felt like realistic baseball. And I think that a huge part of that was them being able to partner with Fox Sports and with MLB to, you know, put them in Petco and have her wear a Padres uniform, right? These weren't like made up teams in a made up league. Like, she was able to bring with her all the history of baseball. They were able to bring all of that into the show because they were able to make it a real thing, right? So, I thought that that part of it they did really well. And I think the other part that they needed to sort of make realistic is the experience of being a woman in a workplace that is predominantly populated by and peopled by men. And I thought they did a really fantastic job of that too. And so I liked it. I think, you know, a baseball season is sort of lends itself to narrative beats, right? Like, I tend to think about baseball happening in chapters. I think that there are obvious sort of moments where there's tension and then things relax and there's drama again and there's joy and there's sadness. And I feel like all of that stuff really lends itself nicely to drama. And so I don't know how sort of faithfully they will follow a season as the way that they formulate this show and how much they bop back and forth. But I think there's a lot of really great potential here. It is a show on Fox, and so it was a little soapy at times, right? Or melodramatic. And we will say, spoilers, everyone, like, there are some weird turns that this took, right? Like, we learned that her father, who is sort of this conniving, overbearing sports dad, who we keep seeing on screen in real time, is actually dead. So he is like a ghost dad, and I did not enjoy that as a dramatic conceit. I hope that goes away very quickly.
I didn't like anything about that storyline, except I understand maybe they had to do it to push the young lady, but I didn't like that storyline at all.
Yeah, it felt a little overdone, right? Like, that is a very familiar sports story. I don't remember the name of the movie, but there is like literally a baseball movie this year about that dynamic between a father and a son. So that is sort of a played out
Todd Marinovich Senior on steroids to me a little bit too. So
right, yeah. So I think there were parts of it that weren't perfect, but part of this too is that, you know, every TV show's pilot, if you go back and watch it, isn't that great, like, compared to where good shows end up. Because there's all this work that they have to do in a pilot, right? Like, they have to introduce all these characters. They have to establish the stakes of the show. They have to build a world. They have to do all this stuff that is sort of bureaucratic and procedural more than anything else, because they need you to come back next week kind of knowing who the people are on the screen. So I think, you know, we won't have a really great understanding of where the show is going until we've had a couple more of them. But I thought it was promising. I mean, I am a fan of catchers because I love pitch framing and find their role in baseball really fascinating. So to have like Zach freaking Morris being a sassy, charming catcher guy, I was like, I'm on board with the show. Like, I'm here for this. So I hope it continues to evolve in a way that is good and interesting. I'm a little nervous that they're going to have her fall in love with her catcher, and that's going to get dicey, but we will see.
Yeah, I'm my biggest complain is probably too strong of a word, but I don't know where after the pilot they go from here. It seemed like they rushed almost to the ending. It feels like it's spoilers. She pitches terribly the first time. Then the next time she comes out and pitches reasonably well, it kind of felt like, you know, if this was a mini movie, you could have ended it there in a lot of ways. So I'm curious now where they're going to take another 12 episodes this season or whatever it is. And if you try to write, you know, 4, 5, 6 seasons of a sitcom, I just don't know where they're going to take this.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. But I think, you know, think about it the way that I sort of am thinking about it is think about it in terms of a career of a pitcher, right? There are plenty of pitchers who come up for a spot start or two. They end up being not significant role players and they sort of fizzle out and we stop being interested in them. And then there are plenty of pitchers who come up and they do a couple spot starts and they evolve and they learn how to do a new thing or they learn how to do what they already do better. And then suddenly they're the guy that you watch every 4 days, every 5 days, you know, for like 10 years. So
yeah, that's a
it'll
good point.
Be interesting to see sort of where they're able to take her character. And I think that for better or worse, the most realistic part of this of the whole thing to me was the interaction that she was having, not only with the guys in the clubhouse who were just sort of skeptical about a woman being in baseball on its face, but they have this other pitcher who she's coming up to start for, and it's not clear from the pilot if he's not starting because he's hurt or because he's been ineffective, but she's coming up to replace this guy who looks crazily like Clay Buchholz. Can we talk about how they like?
It's
they
a had little weird. Him. It's a little weird.
It's eerie. I can't imagine you like make it. No offense, Clay. Make a person look like that on purpose without it being some kind of homage. But this guy did a thing, sort of portrayed behavior that I will admit having experienced at various points in my life, where part of why sort of inclusivity can be threatening to people isn't just fear of the unknown, but fear of displacement, right? This guy is worried about losing his job. His mm-hmm. concern isn't that she is going to come up and pitch terribly and then get sent back to the minors and like embarrass the Padres. They're the Padres. They're kind of embarrassment proof at this point. His concern is that she's going to pitch better than he does and he's going to lose his job because there's still only 25 roster spots, yeah. Even if there's a woman in there now. So I think that there's a lot just sort of from a workplace perspective for them to unpack and sort of sort through here. So
correct. Unfortunately, that was very realistic.
Oh man. I was like, yeah, I've had a version of this conversation. I don't throw a screwball and I would not be a good pitcher, but I have been on the receiving end of some of this before. So, I think there's a lot that they can do that isn't just about the baseball. And thankfully, the baseball looks pretty good and realistic. So I think that for people who want to see a show that portrays the sport that they care about in a way that won't make them cringe, this does a really good job of that. So
yeah, I agree. Although I could do without, please just don't do the screwball and try to do screwy movements with it. That one kind of threw me off.
It is a weird. Well, I was talking about this with a couple of people because I thought that it's hard to film pitching. You know, with
1,000%. You know, I'd almost just rather them, you know, stick the glove and just show the image of it hitting the glove or something.
But the weird thing was when they did that a couple of times, the receiving looked a little odd. It was almost as if they couldn't quite get the velocity on the CGI ball right. I know Ben and Sam had the like baseball coordinator of the show, who's I'm embarrassed to say his name is escaping me right now, but they had him on Effectively Wild. And he was talking about how they did a CGI ball because they thought that the movement was more realistic because, you know, she's an actor playing this part and she can't actually throw 90, even though her character is supposed to sit sort of high 80s, low 90s on the fastball. So they wanted to give the ball like the appearance that an 89 mile an hour fastball would have. And so they CGI'd the ball, and they also did it for safety reasons, right? Because if she, you know, misses terribly and hits, you know, Zach Morris, that's not his name either as a character or human being, but that is effectively his name.
No, that's his name. He should just have that on his ID. Yeah.
I know his name is actually Mike Lawson on the show, and I do appreciate that they made the catcher named Mike because that's fantastic. But you know, they don't want her to accidentally like hit him and then their actor who's playing a catcher is injured. So they CGI'd the ball, but it just made the receiving look a little bit wrong, just a little wrong, because it seemed like the baseball was getting to his glove and he was closing it in a way that wasn't timed quite right. So that was a little distracting, but that's only because I'm in the habit of watching catching really closely. I can't wait to evaluate Mike Lawson's framing.
That's going to be a great column when you write that this winter.
I'm so excited. I hope it's good. I hope they tell him it matters. I wonder if I can get the BP stats team to like run stats. We won't have pitch effects, so we can't actually do it. But I am going to have to visually grade his framing at some point.
All right, I'm putting out the Harry Pavlidis bat signal. We need him immediately. Yeah.
Come on, Harry, help us.
Well, Meg, I could chat with you. There's so many other topics I haven't even gotten into, but kind of for brevity and for your time, I'd love to kind of cut it here. Spot for your plugs where people can find your work online, on Twitter, and anything you want to plug.
Yeah, I write every week at Baseball Prospectus. I'll be, as I said, sort of co-reviewing pitch on a weekly basis, but actually writing about real baseball. So you can find my work there. You can find me on Twitter at Meg Rowler.
my favorite Twitter handle out there.
Well, and if you do, you will see it in various stages of anxiety as we get into this stretch run for the Mariners. So I apologize in advance for being overly fixated on one team. I promise I watch other baseball, but they are the most compelling one to me at the moment. So.
Well, Meg, thank you very much for coming on. I wish the Mariners good luck for you and another 10 good days of baseball.
Thank you. Good luck. Good luck to your Nationals. We like them out here. They're good. They're a good NL team.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad we're popular out there. So good luck, and hopefully maybe we'll meet in the playoffs. That would be the best.
Oh, man. It would be the two teams that don't have a World Series.
That's true.
Mm. Well, yeah. World Series appearance, right? They're the only two that haven't gone.
Exactly right.
Yeah. See, that would be so much fun. Let's hope for that.
All right. I'll have you back. You got to come back on if that happens.
Oh my gosh. I'm here for that.
We'll do that. And then we probably won't speak to each other for a week. So,
well, you know, we'll get over it.
True. Well, Meg, thank you so very much. And I look forward to talking to you somewhere down the road.
Sounds good.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
And that was episode 78 of the Nats GM Show with Baseball Prospectus author Meg Rowley. That was a lot of fun. Big fan of her work. You should definitely check out her work every week over at Baseball Prospectus and follow her on Twitter, as not only does she have the best Twitter handle out there, but she's also a great follow as well. So definitely check out her work. And I would like to remind you that our interview with Meg was sponsored by No Halftime and the No Halftime app. If you're wondering what No Halftime is, please let me fill you in a little bit. You're staring at your weekly fantasy opponent and thinking to yourself, I would love to challenge just one of his players, not his entire team. But your fantasy sports service doesn't allow you to. Now you can on the all-new No Halftime app. The No Halftime app allows you to create individual challenges using players or teams. For example, you can pit Bryce Harper versus Manny Machado, Mike Trout versus Miguel Cabrera, or Chris Davis versus Ichiro. Creating a challenge takes seconds, and accepting challenges is even easier. No Halftime challenges can be private or public and created for the MLB, NFL, NBA, NHL, PGA, and other sports. Join today and get started. And now you can also try No Halftime for free with $0 challenges. Visit NoHalftime.com for more information and to download the No Halftime app for your iPhone or Android device. Receive a bonus by entering in the promo code NATSGM at signup. Receive a free t-shirt when you make a deposit. No Halftime, where the fantasy sports season never takes a break. Everybody definitely check out No Halftime and the No Halftime app. Big fan of their product, obviously sponsor, and big fan of what they got going on. I've been using it a lot for fantasy football recently, so definitely check them out, both for baseball and for football this fall when you are doing your fantasy stuff. So thanks for listening. Bye for now.